sound.
Two guys with no credentials.
Reviewing Rolling Stone 500
greatest album.
Welcome back, everyone. Thanks for joining us once again here at the Sound Logic Podcast. And today we are excited to discuss album number 98 in Rolling Stone Magazine's Top 500 Greatest Albums list. This is Car Wheels on a Gravel Road by Lucinda Williams.
If you've been a listener of the podcast for a while, you know that we tackle these blocks of albums in groups of 10 or so. And when we get to the end of a group of 10, we do our own re-ranking and say which ones were our favorites. We also usually look ahead. This was an album, as we were looking ahead, where Mike and I both said, boy, I don't really know anything about this album. Maybe we better find some people who know. So I did a Facebook search for Lucinda Williams' name and realized, embarrassingly, that she had been in our town and I didn't realize it, and that a couple good friends had been in attendance at that concert and reached out, and they were kind enough to say, yeah, we'll join you on this podcast. And so tonight we're joined by Pia and Sue, two good friends and two kind of kindred spirits in the fight for more justice and equality in our small mountain college town here in State College, Pennsylvania. We were lamenting how long it's been since we've connected in person, but I'm so glad to have the two of you here tonight. In my work as a community organizer and campus minister, our paths would cross fairly frequently, especially around causes that we're all passionate about, like LGBT inclusion. But since shifting gears to being mostly a stay-at-home dad, that just hasn't happened as often anymore. So I'm glad to reconnect in this way, though, and have you both with us. As a way of introduction, how do you introduce yourselves these days, the two of you, and how you move about the world?
So my name is Pia. I am married to Susan. I identify as a woman and a lesbian. I'm a professor at Penn State and a mental health counselor.
Oh, that's a very short introduction.
Do you want
There's
more?
A whole lot more to you that we'll get to, I'm sure, as the episode rolls along.
All right. So I'm Sue. I identify in the queer community as well. She, her, my pronouns. I'm married to Pia. And I'm actually a retired school counselor, although I have worked as a school counselor for the past 2 years in long-term substitute positions. And I'm also a cross-country coach at our local high school.
I've got a seventh grader who's getting more and more excited about heading to high school here these days. And she's got long legs. Maybe I need to nudge her towards cross-country.
We'll see. Let's talk about that afterwards.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Mike, how do you want to get rolling here this evening?
Well, I first want to say thank you again to Pia and Sue for joining us. And this is our first time meeting because I'm not in the same town. And after hearing that introduction from both of you, I want to get to know you more now. But we'll have to do that another time.
Come to State College and have a beer with us.
Yeah. There you go.
Man, I need to do that. And as Ben keeps reminding me, it's only 6 hours away, so I need to hop in the car and come down. Well, next time, I will come and join you for sure. I think we should just give some details on this wonderful album first, before we start talking about it and about our interactions with it. So this album, released June 30th, 1998, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. This is Lucinda Williams' fifth studio album. All tracks written by Lucinda Williams, except I Can't Let Go, written by Randy Weeks, and Still I Long for Your Kiss, co-written by Williams and Dwayne Jarvis. So she was the creative behind most of this album. It charted well on the Canadian country charts, went to number 14, and on the Billboard in the U.S. went up to number 65. And I think it debuted at 68, so not too bad for a country album on what is usually mostly a pop and rock chart. Certified gold in the U.S. and to date, or in 2014, 872,000 copies sold in the U.S. alone. There's a lot of interesting history. I won't read everything about this album, but she experienced some good success from her previous album called Sweet Old World. And some artists like Tom Petty covered, and I think Emmylou Harris, they covered some of the songs, and that gained her a little more popularity, mm-hmm. even with some of the other artists. So this was an anticipated album. And in many ways, a lot of people consider this a breakthrough album for a new genre, which was called alt country. Also, it wasn't really a genre yet, but the Americana genre, this is considered an important album at the beginning of Americana. The initial recording sessions for this album, which was released in 98, started back in 95. And she recorded a lot of the album, and she wasn't happy with her vocals. She decided to start from scratch. And
we hear this every once in a while. I'm just blown away when the studio says okay to that plan, like, or your label, where you've invested so much in this person, they're like, nope, not good enough, let's start over.
So she said that this is a quote from Williams. She said, "I was trying to grow. I didn't want to make another Sweet Old World," which was her previous album. She wanted something new. So her producer she started with, Gerf Morlix, said that he thought the album was about 90% done when she decided to scrap it and start over. So she was collaborating with another artist, Steve Earle, and she asked him to help, which really made Gerf Morlix very upset, and he eventually stepped down from the project. So Steve Earle came in as a co-producer. So we've also talked about some of these big production changes.
Yeah.
Sometimes really can change, obviously, how an album goes. And when it's a successful album, we tend to say, oh, the change made it better. So that could be the case here. Just a couple more quick notes here. Steve Earle appears as a guest on the album as well as Emmylou Harris, a legendary country folk artist. This album won the Grammy Award in 99 for the Best Contemporary Folk Album. And also she had a nomination for Best Female Rock Vocal Performance for the single Can't Let Go. So we see this crossover between country and rock and folk that she's blending all these genres in this album and in her music.
Yeah, I mean, and this is more just a tidbit about Lucinda Williams, too.
Right.
Mary Chapin Carpenter actually sang her song, her really popular song, Passionate Kisses, was actually written by Lucinda Williams.
Okay.
Which a lot of people don't know. You know that song.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back in 1988, I think. So well before this album. But I think that in some ways, that probably definitely launched her into more of the spotlight. Mary Chapin Carpenter won a Grammy for that. And Williams won Best Country Song for writing it. So
Mike and I turned 40 last year. So in 1998, we were in the prime era of our CD buying lives, like late teen years. Like most of our paychecks were going to purchasing music. And I
100%
feel so
disposable income.
I feel so embarrassed that this pivotal late 90s album totally passed me by, and I've been trying to sort of narrow down why that is this week. I know I had a strong chauvinistic bias against female artists for some reason in my high school years, and I also had a pretty strong bias against country music, so perhaps there were two things working against me in that case. But she sounds so much like in the same sort of sweet spot of so many artists that I love today. It makes me just sort of like hurt inside that this brilliant thing was out there, just totally oblivious, probably just a rack or two over from wherever I was browsing in the CD store, not accessing this. It's been actually a lovely kind of bittersweet gift, I guess, to stumble upon it much after its debut. But I'm glad we're here tonight.
Just before we get into some of our reflections here, we'd love to talk about album covers, the artwork. I think it shares so much of an identity with an album.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is a very simple photograph, and it's almost split in half horizontally. If you Google it right now, have a look at it. The top is the sky, and the bottom is the dirt road, mostly, leading towards a little house with, you can see, you know, patio lights, different colors. It's very small. And then the title is in the top, takes up most of the thing. I don't know. I'm not a font expert, but this looks like the kind of font that you'd have, like, kids' fridge magnets. It looks like that's the shape of the letter. And yeah. Very interesting design choice is they're not in line. They're slightly out of alignment. Lucinda Williams is just a slightly larger font than the title underneath, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. And I thought, is that supposed to emulate us driving on the gravel road of being bumpy and out of line? I don't know. Really interesting choice. And then the color is, or the photo, I mean, the things, the only objects, the house and a car, they're not in focus. So it's a really, really interesting artistic image. And this, sometimes I see an album cover, and even though I never knew what the album was, I say, hey, I've seen that image before. That's familiar. Mm-hmm. This was not familiar to me. Now, I think I'll open this up to anybody, to those, and I think, Sue, you said earlier before we went on that you've started listening to her music more recently. Did I get that right earlier?
Right.
So was this album cover, was the art familiar to anybody before you'd seen it? Or is this, I'd never really seen it.
Nope.
So there you go.
Not at all. Actually, but it reminds me of driving home. That's what I think of when I see that picture. Mm. You know, you're going down your road and the lights are on.
Yes.
And you're heading into home.
Yeah, especially for those of us who grew up in areas with dirt roads or gravel driveways, there's something very nostalgic about this.
Yes.
This image is actually from a photographer from the state of Mississippi. His name is Bernie Imes, and it's one of a number of images in a collection he has called Juke Joint. So that, those sort of glowing, twinkly, colorful lights that you were mentioning there, Mike, is welcoming people into the local juke joint.
Okay.
This is a collection of photos documenting the vanishing of the black juke joints from the Mississippi Delta in photographs. Okay. And this one in particular is called Turk's Place. It's in LaFleur County, and it was taken in 1989, so about a decade before this album came out. I like that even more. You can, not only does it feel like maybe going home, but you can almost hear the music in the distance, right, as you're pulling down the long lane to this little off the beaten path kind of music place.
That's really cool.
It is.
So let's move in to the music, and this is what I'm excited to talk about. And really what I'd like to do first, and what we usually do, and we can workshop it a bit if we want, but I'd like to hear from you, Pia and Susan, how you got into her music.
Yeah.
And we could start with that. It doesn't have to be about this album, and then more specifically, kind of some of the impact and reflections on this album in particular. So anybody, you can decide amongst yourself who goes first, but I really want to hear about your interactions with this.
Sure. I'll go first.
Thanks, Pia.
So I'm 50, so just a touch older than the two of you.
You're 51?
Oh, actually, I am 51. Thanks for reminding me.
Last week.
Thanks for reminding me, wifey. And, you know, ironically, I didn't know of Lucinda Williams back when this album came out. I was on the opposite side of Ben, I was in this very, like, kind of feminist, lesbian, identity building stage in my life, where I was pretty much only listening to, like, lesbian artists, the Indigo Girls and Melissa Etheridge and that whole kind of genre. So folk was certainly in my wheelhouse. Ani DiFranco was a really big influencer on my musical taste at that time. But I had also, right around that time, had also just moved to Texas. And so there was this little bit of me that was getting a little bit more comfortable with some country, some like Shania Twain and more of the sort of pop country artists. But I actually was first introduced to listen to Williams by a friend, a Canadian male friend, you'll be happy to know. Who was like, how have you never heard of Listen to Williams? And I was like, oh no, I just haven't. And so he made me like a mixtape back when that was a thing. I guess it was a CD probably, of some Listen to Williams songs. And that was my first introduction. And I remember, you know, kind of driving around with the CD on just repeat. I loved her music. I loved her raspy voice. I think a lot of her lyrics are very poetic. There's definitely this very sort of strong feminine female power trait, I think, that goes through not only her lyrics but also just the sound of her voice. And I just fell in love with it. I mean, my favorite is not from this album of her songs, but two of my favorites: Righteously, which was from an album that came out a few years later, and Those 3 Days. And so those were from her album World Without Tears, which came out in 2003, which was probably right around the time that I was introduced to her. So, but Cartwheels on a Gravel Road definitely got incorporated, as did her earlier album as well. And when I found out she was coming, I was super excited to introduce Sue to her music. And that was her first time.
That's my first, yeah.
She was like, all right, I'll go to this concert with you. I have no idea who this person is. I was gobsmacked.
Well, I think because I was introduced to it, to her live, we were maybe in the third row.
Yeah.
I mean, we were very close to the stage. And there she was, right in front of us.
And just her and her guitar.
Yeah. Just the power. Well, I think there were backup.
Was there?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't remember the backup. I just remember her.
Because she was so stage central, you know. But just the power and the songs. She's such a visual singer for me. I mean, I can see what she's singing about, because she paints that picture so well. And to have her right there in front of me belting out these songs was... It's one of the best concerts I ever went to. And I'm not a country music fan, per se.
I didn't listen to country, though.
No,
she's like rock folk.
But I listened to Mary Chapin and Shania Twain and, you know, some of those people. Mm-hmm. But so that was like, what, 2018? Whenever she was here?
Well, you know, Ben, like that.
When she was here in State
College.
It
was before COVID, so.
But in 1995, I was birthing my second child and married to a man, and you know, was up to my eyeballs in diapers and bottles and potty training and
not paying attention to what was cool at the time. I know her sound has changed slightly through the years. She's always had that commanding voice, that power, and that storytelling ability, but I think she has played a little bit with genre, which maybe makes her a little hard to categorize, perhaps, with where exactly to classify her. In what space?
Well, and listening to her live, her voice had even more of that vibrato that now than it did when she cut that album. So that tone. And it's pretty amazing. Mm. Yep. So we listen to Lucinda Williams now a lot in our car when we're on road trips.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's a very special thing, Sue, to experience an artist for the first time. The first time you experience artists, to experience them live.
Yeah.
And I can hear in your telling the story, recalling it, how much that's impacted you. That's really, really cool.
And with someone you love too. Like, even though you didn't listen to Joni Mitchell for the first time live, sitting down with your spouse, who's been a diehard fan for her whole life, I think totally changed that for you, right, Mike? The sort of experience of like someone who wasn't going to let you not like this music. You know?
Yeah, that was. You're making me relive that moment now. no, but it is special when someone says, almost holds your hand, this is special to me. Come and enjoy this with me, and that your first time will be with me. That's really really cool. Good point. Good. I wasn't even thinking about that. You brought that in. That's great. and now that's an album and an artist that I absolutely adore. So. I can certainly relate to that in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think crowd sat during that concert. I don't remember sitting. I think we stood the whole time.
Mm-hmm. It was at the State Theater, which is a seated venue, but they stood. Wow, huh?
And that's a small venue where we've been to concerts before, where they're kind of a little. They get a little like sit down at you,
right.
And they didn't even try at this. Everyone was on their feet from like the second she walked on the stage.
Lots of energy.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I don't want to talk as much this episode as we normally do. I'd like to leave it to our guests, but I do want to hear from you as kind of what were your first reactions when you pressed play.
Yeah, I think like I said, how did I not hear this sooner? And also, what might I have done with it if I had? I hear a lot of late 90s Sheryl Crow in this album, and I wasn't a huge fan of Sheryl Crow, and you know, maybe for the reasons I mentioned earlier, would have dismissed it right away instead of maybe I needed to wait another 25 years to get to the point where I was good about that. I hear a lot of Amy Mann. I hear some. I hear how Brandi Carlile has borrowed some from her, and it's just it hit me a lot harder than I was expecting. Maybe there's some 90s elements to it that we'll get to whether it sounds dated or not later in the episode, but there's elements that don't sound like some of the people I'm listening to right now, but it's really good and it feels really comfortable and familiar for an artist that I've really never heard before in my life, and has been a really really nice discovery to find myself at that point too. We listen to new music all the time in this journey through Rolling Stone's list of the greatest albums of all time, and I think I expected to be wowed by more of the albums than I have been. There's there's lots that I'm just like, I can see why this is good, but it's not tugging at my personal palate or heart or something like that. And this one, I pressed play and was immediately like, okay, yeah, I'm okay here. How about you, Mike? What was it like for you? That ominous moment pressing play.
Yeah, I don't know if I could say a whole lot that's not repeating almost verbatim what you said. There was something very, very familiar. Yeah. And we've had this before a few times. One I could think of when we listened to Erykah Badu, and I wasn't familiar with that album, but I was like, this sounds like so many other things that came along in the 90s. And when we...
After it.
Yeah, so now I'm hearing, and not just this album, but her career from her first, Lucinda Williams, from her first album, I'm starting to hear, wow, I've heard her influence in all these artists I grew up with and had no idea. Because the very first thing, the first track, her vocal, I was like, well, this sounds a bit like a Courtney Love type vocal. Different in many ways, but I heard similarities. And then you get to the next track, and I'm thinking, well, now I hear Sheryl Crow. And really what I'm hearing is the impact that she's had on those artists. I heard her vocal is very much in front of the music. That has to do with the mixing too, but they put her vocal way out, which is appropriate because she has a very strong vocal. It's interesting that she is very self-conscious of her vocal because I think it's wonderful. Very clear, very crisp. Still Southern, mm-hmm. very Southern, yeah. but wonderful. Nice. And so that was the first thing that struck me. The second thing was, we've talked about a guy like Bob Dylan, who make one of the things, ways he makes his music so relatable is he talks about places and mm-hmm. specific places and general places, you know, like I've been to New Orleans or I spent this time in a bar or in a factory. Mm-hmm. Bruce Springsteen does that too. And I heard that a lot here. She's dropping mm-hmm. all these places she's been to, and how relatable is that? One thing I've learned, and Pia, you mentioned this, I think Americans much more than Canadians, some of it's due to military and some of it not, is that many Americans move around a lot and live in many different states. I think that happens less for Canadians. I don't know, Ben, if you can say that or not, but
never thought about that before, but yeah,
many of the guests
gut reaction is yes, that's true.
Many of the guests we've had that, you know, that I'm meeting for the first time said, well, I lived in, you know, I lived in California and then I lived in Texas and I lived in, and it's me. It's like, well, I've been in, you know, around this city for my whole life. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of Canadians, at least Ontarians, stay kind of in the same place, or maybe they go out to Vancouver because they want to be more Western or coastal. Anyways, so I think there's something very relatable to all these different places. And for her, it's mostly in the South, which is appropriate for her for upbringing. And that's something I noticed too. And boy, doesn't that draw you in when you can go, oh, I've been there. I can place myself there. And the last thing before I want to stop talking, in the title track, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, and she's describing in sentences all these sights and sounds and things. And I closed my eyes and thought about the sound of car wheels on a gravel road. And I hadn't realized how much of an impact that's had in my life growing up rural. I couldn't hear it. I could feel it. When someone's coming down your lane, you could feel that. You know, you can almost tell, and I don't know if either of you have experienced it, you can almost tell who it is sometimes. I know that car.
The speed that they're traveling.
Yeah, the speed or the tires.
That it makes. Yeah.
The weight of the vehicle. That's a truck. That's a little car. That must be so-and-so in their, you know, Toyota Tercel or whatever. so I just felt that was so visual, so visceral, the way she described all those very common, very relatable sights and sounds of being in a small town. That was just really... Ben, I'm still living in the small town that we grew up in, but it's not so small anymore, and it doesn't always feel so rural anymore. But I grew up, you know, on family farms, working on farms, being out in the country. So a lot of those things were really relatable. So those are the things that struck me on a first listen, and I'm still trying to absorb as much of this as possible. The last thing I'll say before I turn it over again is I too, Ben, had some sort of bizarre gut reaction against country music growing up. I don't know what it was. Why did that happen? We had that. I hate country. I can't stand this crap. Did you have that too, Sue?
Yeah, and I grew up in a small town.
Where did that come from? Because I had so many friends who the same thing. Oh, country sucks. That's so twangy. So I really enjoy it now. it's not the main genre I listen to, but I love it. I love the musicality, the guitars, you know, really twangy guitar on this album is very much in the forefront, and it's a beautiful sound. So anyways, steer it away from me here.
Well, yeah, I'm coming up with all kinds of theories as to why.
No.
There might be that country music bias. I wonder too if it's like a posture thing. Like if you are in a small town, if committing to country music commits to the area, and if you want to be open to that movement, to that, like this is not where I'm gonna define myself or whatever. Then you reject it as a like too conservative. Maybe I don't know. this is getting a little rambly here. as a new to this artist kind of person, what I find myself wondering is, how does Car Wheels on a Gravel Road fit into her other albums for the two of you? Is this your favorite of her many great works? Is it one that you return to more than others? Or I guess I should also ask, are there a number of her albums in rotation at your house or on Spotify or whatever, or is it just this one?
Yeah, I mean, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road comes up a lot for us, right. Definitely.
Because there's so many songs on it that are good. Great.
Yeah.
It's hard to find one that I dislike it in any mm-hmm. way, shape, or form. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The only other one that I would say is on heavy rotation for me is World Without Tears, which came out in 2003. And okay. It's a much more... She's much raspier. Yeah. She's much more... There's like this kind of fierceness in the lyrics on that album.
It feels that way.
Yeah.
A little more behind it.
A little more badass behind it. Maybe a little bit more into rock. I think that album and her voice on that album reminds me a lot of Janis Joplin.
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow.
There's definitely like that component. It feels much more like 60s rock.
Yeah.
In some ways for me, 60s, 70s, than a 2003 album.
That's
sure.
So interesting.
Yeah.
We've noticed that some of these artists with these really commanding voices almost are separate than their peers. Like they can be kind of sound like they're in different eras. Springsteen and Dylan, who we've mentioned already, both have that quality of like, doesn't sound like who you were singing with at that time. Maybe you were, you know, time traveler. Yeah. It could be just about anywhere.
Yeah, seriously, it's so true.
I don't think there's another album I know as well.
Okay. As Car Wheels.
Right.
We mentioned, I think off mic, it was before we began, right, that she'd had a stroke a few years ago. 2020, I think Wikipedia says. But she's still touring and still recording. She's got an album due out June of 2023. So as we're recording, just a month away. So still pretty prolific, I guess, for someone who's lived a full life.
And I think she didn't really get much traction until she was in her 40s or 50s, I think. So okay. I think that also maybe potentially has an impact on her movement forward. And her, I think there's a lot that she has left to do. In a sense, because of that, I think, you know, I was reading this article about her, and she's coming out with a memoir soon, or it's coming out at some point. And she was talking about that she was in Austin kind of trying to hit up the bars, and this would have been in the late 80s, kind of early 90s. And they were kind of like, yeah, we have enough female singers, you know, because it was a pretty prolific time, I think, for female singers back then, right? Really making inroads into the music world on their own, and really playing to like a female audience in particular, like thinking about Shania Twain coming out of those people, right? But thinking about like the early Indigo Girls and Ani DiFranco and Melissa Etheridge and Amy Mann and, right, all of those really awesome female-centered musicians and bands. So I could kind of see her being like, yeah, we got enough. in a really kind of unfortunate way. Because I think one of the things that I love so much about her music, and Sue kind of touched on it, was, you know, when you're listening to her lyrics, it's almost like watching it play out. And there's been a couple, and I haven't done this since I was like, you know, 15, where I've gone back and like pulled up lyrics because I feel like I need to sit with them a little bit more, and I need to really like, okay, I have to read it. I can't just listen to it or hear it at the same time, because her lyrics are powerful. And I think her songs are like poetry. They're just beautifully constructed.
and I think stand alone, could probably stand alone as poetry too. I know her dad was a poet, so I'm sure that there was some influence there, and he was a professor as well, I think, of literature. So, yeah.
Well,
But that comes through very strongly for me.
We've talked a number of times on the podcast about the way we consume music now with streaming. We don't have the lyric book in our hands, right? So even if we want to,
or
you have to almost
cover album, right?
Right,
or the,
right.
Yeah.
It's a bit more of a challenge. I mean, I guess it's a lot easier to Google lyrics now than it was in the 90s, but you do have to take an effort. You can't just pull out the piece of paper and read that. And they are so beautiful too. I mean, some of what we've already talked about, the specificity of her music. She's not talking in vague notions. She's pulling on your heart with very specific touchstones, key points, places, activities, events. What do you think, Mike? Do you want to talk about specific tracks, or what do we still want to cover here before we get to our final thoughts?
I have an idea. So let's do favorite tracks, and then we can talk about other tracks too. So we always pick two tracks. We have a Spotify playlist. And we pick two tracks from every album that we review. Mm-hmm. We put it on the playlist. It's called Sound Logic Favorites. Anybody can go listen to it. And when we have a guest, we'd love for our guests to pick the track to go on there. So
we have two guests. It works out perfectly.
No pressure. So
we would love if you would each pick a track to go on this playlist. It can be your favorite or a song that you think best represents the album or you would want someone to hear. But I think you should pick your favorite. And if you have the same favorite, then someone gets to pick something else. So and feel free to tell us why it's your favorite.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. I'll go. It's really easy for me to say Drunken Angel is my favorite because there's just something so catchy about that song. But I love Joy.
Sounds a little different than the rest of the album, doesn't it?
It does. And I like everything about it. Yeah, it is different. And I like the power behind it. Mm-hmm. So, but... You know, I also it's hard not to pick Right in Time too. So I'm gonna pick Joy.
Okay, that's a good choice.
I love the southern feel to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the guitar that's like? I don't know if it's a pedal steel guitar or something, but there's like one of those metal bodied guitars. There's a different tonal sound there to that guitar.
Yeah, so I initially was going to go with Drunken Angel too, just because it is that sort of catchy one on there.
It's so easy to sing.
It is.
Did you hold hands to that one at the concert? Is that like that?
I don't think we did.
We danced together.
We did, I'm sure. But another one that I really like is Concrete and Barbed Wire.
Okay.
And I think I like it more for the lyrics than anything else.
The lyrics are good.
And I think it's so, so one of the things you were saying was like, does it play now, right? Yeah. Given that this is like an older album. Right. And I think this does, actually,
really?
The song.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the first lines in it is, this wall divides us, we're on two different sides.
Oh, the words.
But this wall is not real. How can it be real? It's only made of concrete and barbed wire. I was listening again to the album this week, and I kind of had it on repeat. And I was thinking about how timely that is and how much it feels so relevant to what's going on politically and socially in the U.S., and some of the sort of struggles that we're facing, you know, as a country. And so I think it really speaks to me in that sense.
So which one are you going to pick?
So I think I think I'm going to pick that one.
Concrete and Barbed Wire.
Yeah.
Like We've managed to reference five songs now.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
So that's good. Good for you. Mike, do you want to tell us what you would have picked? What song jumps out to you? And I'll do the same. We don't usually do that when we've got guests, but it would be a way to explore another track or two.
Yeah.
Or
I think, and I've already talked about it a good amount, but I think the title track, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road, just really, really resonated with me. And I love the way she's written that one, the lyrics. Yeah. Well, I love the music of it too, but the lyrics really, really got to me. I've come back to that one a few times. So that would be my favorite. What about you? Do you have one?
Yeah, you're all wrong. The best song is... No. This happens a lot when we're doing this. I'll press play with the first track and get like six or seven songs in, and something will distract me. I've got to go make dinner or do the dishes or something, and I don't get around to the final few tracks. And I'm so glad I did on this album, because Jackson, the very last track, is my favorite. It's such a beautiful song. Again, similar to Joy, kind of a different sound than the rest of the album. It's maybe a little sweeter sounding than some of the aggressive songs on the playlist, but I really, really like it. And need to find a playlist of my own so I don't forget about that one. It's a neat album.
Mm-hmm.
Good choices. It wasn't a bad song here, so it's a...
Yeah, right. Yeah. And I think that speaks to it. Like, there's something for everyone on this album, right? Like,
very diverse.
You can go for the kind of sweeter or fiercer.
Yeah.
You know, there's some that are more kind of wanderlusty.
Yeah.
Reminiscent sort of songs. Lake Charles, I think, is one that's very similar to that, right? So I think I almost feel like you could go through almost every emotion listening to all of the songs on this album.
She talks about Lake Charles in another song.
Mm-hmm. She does,
She references it.
Yeah.
Interesting. We like to try and set the albums we discuss into our present context, which can be challenging at times. Mm-hmm. You've already done a little bit of that for us, Pia, in relating some of the lyrics to current situations. We've evolved how we ask this question over time, but what we're settling right now on is kind of how the album has aged. Has it aged? What has aged well? What hasn't, if anything, in either of those? So do I have a volunteer in the class? Someone raised their hand. Who wants to go first? I feel like you have something prepared, Pia.
I don't have anything prepared, but just in thinking about it, I think it's aged well. And I think one of the reasons is that when I listen to this album, I feel like I'm reminiscing on my own life. And that's what it sort of feels like to me, like she's sort of reminiscing. And that, I think, is something that's sort of timeless, right? That it's that emotion that sort of comes up about thinking about the past is relevant whether it's 2023 or 1998, you know? And I think a lot of, in some ways, I don't think we've come that far, right? So a lot of the social issues she touches on, I think, are still very relevant, unfortunately. I think her as like this sort of strong female singer-songwriter is still very relevant. I really do think it's aged well. And I think her ability to kind of mesh genders and be sort of not like our ability to not kind of nail her down to like this one area, I think has also aged really well.
I feel like that's the case with most artists these days, right? That it's hard to pigeonhole them because they're borrowing on other genres as they're creating their music.
Yeah.
Good points. Boy, it's going to be hard to argue with that. Anyone want to take a stab?
Well, I will say, I think it's, I do think, like, I picked Joy because it's so empowering. Mm-hmm. You know, you took something and I'm taking it back.
Mm-hmm.
So for survivors of sexual assault, for example, that's immediately what I think of when I hear that song.
Wow.
So I love that empowering of taking back what you've lost. And I think that could be, that really could be positive to hear that in this day and time on many issues. So that part, I think some of it's a little, sounds a little 90s to me, or aged in the sense that there's some repetitiveness in some of the songs, you know, that do that constant repeat. And actually Concrete and Barbed Wire, I like the words a lot, but I feel like it's not as exciting for me musically, because it repeats a lot. So yeah, I don't know. You have to go see her live in concert. Just watch her power.
Like,
I mean, that's what sells it. I mean, her, you can hear, you hear her and how she portrays herself, but watching it on stage and being embodied is she becomes that music, and she becomes that power of those words.
She's also just super, like, in concert, and this is a very small venue in our little town, but it felt like she was there with friends. Like, she was, like, telling stories, and she was so
relaxed,
accessible, and that you kind of felt like you knew her already to some degree.
But then we just take your hat off with the song.
Well, and I think a good artist has the ability to take something that might sound a little, like, from a production side of things, stuck in the 90s, and reinvent it and play the same song in a new and more powerful way, too. I think, Mike, I've been thinking since we began when you said her vocals are out front in the production side of things, that it almost sounds like, I know this isn't the case, she's got incredible talent behind her, but it almost sounds like they got a production studio band to sort of play behind her, to sort of elevate her a little bit more. And I think that somehow makes it sound a little bit dated too. Like, it isn't a complete band. It's it's a solo artist kind of, like, elevated above the music.
Two things.
And I also hear some 90s chorus on the guitars, and something about, I can't believe I'm going to say this, something about the snare drum sounds like a 90s snare in there too. Mike's always on about the snare drum sound and how it dates certain things. Apparently I agree in this one case. But other than that, like, I think lyrical content, we keep saying over and over again about how authenticity kind of never ages. She's got that in spades. And as we've mentioned over and over, such a gifted lyricist. I don't think, like, even if someone just spoke these words, I think you would feel them in a very here and now kind of timeliness to them. So it's a bit of a tricky one to pigeonhole or to say what sounds dated here. But I like all the things we've said so far. Do you have anything to add, Mike?
One of the quotes from a guest we've had that we've repeated the most is someone once said, being genuine and sincere will always be relevant. And I felt that very relevant to this album. You know, that you talked about her, I believe, Pia, you were saying, but it really sounds like she's reminiscing on this album. And in learning about her, realizing that she was 45 when it came out, you know, so she's she's got more, you know, a lot of the artists we've talked about are younger, you know, in their 20s, especially some earlier albums from artists. So this is someone in, I guess, think we can say middle age. So, you know, that I think is really, really special, and that will always be relevant. And I think that always ages well when you can be sincere. Someone said, back when I did, Ben's done more of this, but when I did a little preaching way back in the day, someone said, if it's not personal, it's not powerful. And I think about that sometimes as we share our stories, as we, even as we share our art. People can tell when you're not genuine in whatever you present, in anything, even meeting someone on the street, people can tell. And it goes the other way too. People can, it really gets through. So I think that has made it, it resonates no matter what decade we're in. I didn't really listen to country in this time, but we've talked about, you know, I think think someone mentioned Shania Twain, and she was mm-hmm. really exploding on the new country and the country crossover scene.
Right,
so yeah. an album like this that has some very traditional country sounds, or instrumentation rather, is interesting because the country was heading in another direction in the late 90s. So I can't even...
That don't impress me much.
Oh, boy. Oh, brother. So I can't say that it's dated in the way that it sounds like a country album, because a lot of country at this time didn't sound like this. It was headed in another direction. And certainly the male dominated country didn't sound like this either. Very different. So again, it's so unique. So I think it is aged better than the country at the time, because these sounds with the resurgence of indie folk in the 2000s and Americana being very popular, and people going back to a lot of those sounds makes this extremely relevant and aged very well. In fact, probably better than a lot of the things at the time. So it's a thumbs up for me in terms of this. I think if this was played now, I think it might even do better now than when it came out. That's all speculation, but I think that it would fit very well right now in, you know, you could put this up, I think she could perform this stuff with any indie folk act now, and it would fit right in. My two cents for what they're worth. Thank you. That means a lot. So let's move to our last little section here. We like to comment on the rankings. So this is the 98th best album of all time, according to the editors and those polled at Rolling Stone. How do we feel about that? We'll start with you, Sue and Pia. With it's a hard question to answer without being really familiar with the list, but without context, you know, and being a beloved album of yours, an album that you love, how do you feel that this is, you know, ranked in the top 100?
I'm actually really excited that it's ranked in the top 100. And actually, when Ben reached out to me and told me that it was what the podcast was and that it was ranked in the top 100, I was like, hot damn, that's awesome. Because a lot of the music that I like typically isn't ranked in the top 100. It's not typically like mainstream, right? So, I was actually really impressed.
Happily,
especially for an artist that is sort of hard to kind of pigeonhole or nail down. So I don't know that I can comment on like, is 98 a good spot for it? I think I'm so. Right. So grateful that it's in the top 100, and I think it deserves to be. Absolutely.
I feel the same. I can't add much to that.
Well, I think we've made it through 98 albums now. There really hasn't been much Americana country folk stuff here. So, like, for this to be the one of a handful of albums that represent that.
That's true.
That genre outside of pop and rock, I think, is maybe even more significant too.
It's great.
I like it here. I wonder why it passed so many of us by, and how that will play into its lasting legacy. This list gets updated every decade or so. It's jumped an immense amount. It was is it in the low 300s, 304, 305, and then jumped all the way up to 98 here in this 2020 list. Something about this moment in time, we've noticed a lot that the, a list that comes out in the pandemic really seemed to like authenticity people being vulnerable, and it celebrates more diversity than the earlier lists did too. So, we've talked a number of times already tonight about miscategorization of female artists. It took until, what was the first female artist on the old list, Mike? It was like something horrible, like
30. It was Joni Mitchell's Blue.
Joni Mitchell's Blue was the first one, number 30.
First female solo artist, and on this list, that same album is number 3.
And a lot more, more representation.
By the time you get to 30, there's about, you know, I want to say closer to 10 solo female artists. So much more diversity, which makes much more sense.
Yeah.
Especially sure does. Sure.
It made sense when that list came out, but makes makes sense now.
Still doesn't cover the sins of our past.
No.
But we're all making amends, hopefully, small steps.
Well, yeah. I mean, if that, I mean, that alone, I think, speaks to its relevancy today, right? Like, people are still clearly connecting with it. I would love nothing more than for more people to listen to Williams.
Yeah.
Well, we've got two more advocates now who can say this is great stuff here and encourage others to check it out as well.
Nice.
Awesome. We referenced a couple of times that she's got, you know, a lot of other albums. She does have one more on this list at number 426, and this is a new addition. This album wasn't on the other previous iterations. Is her self-titled album from 1988, so a decade previous. Is that her debut, or do I have that wrong?
I think it was,
Yes, I believe so.
So we'll look forward, and perhaps you want to join us in about 10 years when we get around, to that one.
Anything you need, Ben, we're there.
Yep. Okay, good.
Let me, I've fact-checked you, Ben. In fact, that was her third album.
Oh.
And her first was in 79.
Wow.
Yeah.
Boy, she really did take a slow rise to
that
greatness.
79, 80, and then took an 8-year break. And then Sweet Old World in 92. And then, as we discussed, she started recording this in 95.
But it took
almost 3 years to get it finished. So,
yep.
I think that says something, too, about her as an artist.
Yes, which she wanted to put out there. Yeah, she made it right.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, friends, it's so good to reconnect. Next time we'll do it in person. We've got Pride Month coming up here. I'm going to be riding my bike in the parade. Maybe I'll see you there.
You'll see me. I'm lining up the bikers, the cars.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Good. Hopping on my bike at the end.
And lots of family-friendly stuff happening on Friday, too.
Yeah.
Awesome. If you want to bring your kids. Yeah.
Good. Thank you so much for adding your voices to this long and winding journey that we're on. It really means a lot.
Excellent. It was super fun. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great.
It has been great to meet you both.
Me too.
I think this is the saddest I've been coming to the end of an episode. I really enjoyed meeting you and hearing about your passion, your love for this album, and how you've shared it together. That's really, really neat and special. Thank you once again. And
so worth the 6-hour drive, right, Mike,
absolutely.
To come have a beer with us?
Yeah. I need to do that.
Mike's got two pretty fabulous kids, a pretty fantastic spouse, too, who I'm also thinking would enjoy the connection with the two of you. So
make it work. Yes, they would. And if there's any Pride celebrations in town this year, we'll all be there as well. So they would, in fact, maybe that would be an excuse for us to come down. Join you. For now, we'll sign off. Before we do, Ben, would you tell us what we have coming up next time?
Yeah. This is going to be a fun one. Our oldest children are pretty big fans of Taylor Swift, and she's coming up here with her album Red at the number 99 spot. We're almost at 100, and we get one Taylor album here for the sake of the next generation. We're hoping to have their voices on the podcast as well to spend some time with us talking about that album. Taylor's version or the original? I don't know. We'll have to talk about that too.
That will come up in conversation. 100% guarantee you. I'm surprised I don't have someone peeking around the corner commenting on it right now.
Shouting about it. Yeah.
That'll happen. Yeah. For the last time, thank you so much, Pia and Susan, for joining us. Thank you, Ben, again. Thank you for listening. And until next time, we hope you continue to be well. We hope you take care of yourselves and those around you. And of course, we hope you'll join us again right here on the SoundLogic podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks.
If you like what you hear, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and write a review.
Send us a message at our Facebook page, on Instagram, or through our SoundLogic Podcast Twitter feed. Thanks for listening.